37, and we are looking at the patient king, talking about lessons that David learned. By the way, if you have access to the internet, Brother Tim DeLello gave me some guidelines yesterday and worked with me. He came over to Luzerne where I was working. We had no calls, so we worked 6 straight hours on the website. And I think if you go to the website, you'll be impressed. We go to the section that says About Us. And that section has a slideshow of activities around our church. And then we have also DVDs of sermons that I preached at Abundant Life Baptist Church in Proctorville, Ohio. And also we have audio sermons. I guess he's linked it some way with something called YouTube, and so you can play those sermons. And if you don't take notes, you may want to listen to them 2 or 3 times so that you'll get what was in them, right? Okay, remember we've been talking about David's patience, and he's in the waiting process. Last time we were together, we talked about things that you should do in the waiting process. One, don't waste time and energy worrying about what's going on in the lives of others, Psalm 37, 1 and 2. You know, don't be focused on the things that's happening there. Secondly, go ahead and develop the spiritual skill of trusting. And this really takes a, I don't know about you, but I've been saved now 57, almost 58 years, and I'm still working on absolute trust in the Lord, not for salvation, but for the problems of life, things like that. Do develop the spiritual skill of trusting. Thirdly, develop controls over what you delight in. Learn to control what you allow yourself to delight in. Your old nature is going to always want to push something in. And then number four, determined to have the highest commitment level possible. Verse 5, commit thy way unto the Lord, trust also in Him, and He shall bring it to pass. Highest commitment level possible. And by the way, it is not who we are that provides confidence, I think I told you last time. That doesn't provide confidence in the face of troubles. Rather, it is who God is that provides all that we need in the journey of life. David said, as the Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. And so we need to be wrapped up in who the Lord is. The Lord is my shepherd, that's sufficiency. I shall not want, that supply. So we said resting is part of a total process. It's not just a, you know, isolated act. A lot of people think of resting as relaxing, and that's not what he's talking about. The Hebrew word means to be silent toward the Lord. So resting is related to our faith in the Lord. It's not enough to say, I'm trusting Jesus, but you have to actually act like you are. And then secondly, we said resting is related to our commitment level and our relationship to the Lord. Commit thy way unto the Lord. So if I trust His management skills, I'm willing to commit to His choices for me. Now that does not mean that I always like the choices that He makes. But it's important to recognize. And then thirdly, we said resting is related to what we choose to delight in. It's amazing how we create our own frustrations, isn't it? We delight in things that are going to pass away. We delight in things that are only temporary. We delight in things that can't possibly provide our deepest inner needs. And then we wonder why we have vexation, fretting, worrying, and all of that. David said, delight thyself in the Lord. The resting is related to what we choose to delight in. Delighting in Him, trusting in Him, committing to Him. And by the way, those who fret over their circumstances are not going to trust the Lord, they're not going to delight in Him, they're not going to commit to Him. So very important that we keep that in mind. I think I mentioned to you that trust means place confidence in His management skills. Commit means to accept what He manages for us without whether it's pleasant or painful. And then delight means we enjoy our relationship with Him more than we do pleasant circumstances. I come in contact with people all the time, Christians included, who say, well, I wish things were better. Well, actually, what we should be saying is I'm delighting in the Lord. If circumstances affect the way you delight in the Lord, then there's something wrong with the way you delight in the Lord. Because the circumstances are not going to always be good in your life in terms of pleasant they will always be good in terms of God's using them to develop in you what He sees you need. So I think I gave you a definition of resting in the Lord. Here it is again. Resting in the Lord is a release of personal control over one's life to the Lord. Trusting in His choices, committed to His choices, and delighting in Him regardless of His choices. And the resting, of course, we said eliminates a lot of things in our daily living. It eliminates envying evildoers, verse 1. It eliminates anxiety over life in general, verse 2. It eliminates fear of insufficiency, verse 3. It eliminates wrong desires, verse 4. It eliminates worrying about how things will turn out, verse 5. It eliminates being misunderstood, verse 6. And eliminates frustration about others. So, just in summary, we said don't waste time and energy worrying about what's going on with others, verses 1 and 2. Develop the spiritual skill of trusting the Lord, verse 3. And develop controls over what you allow yourself to delight in, verse 4. And then determine to have the highest commitment level possible, verse 5. And then number 5, we said learn to rest in who the Lord is, verse 7. Then number 6, we got started on this one. Number 6, curtail the power of anger in your life. Curtail the power of anger in your life. Verse 8, cease from anger and forsake wrath. Fret not thyself in any wise to do evil. Reuben Ewart used to always illustrate for us how we surrender needlessly control to other people. A guy cut in front this morning, somebody cut in front of me when I was on my way back. And my first response was, I'll show you. My second response was, I'll back off and let the idiot go. Reuben Ewart said, you're really in deep trouble when you say, you make me angry. Because now you've placed control of your life in the hands of somebody else. So don't allow anyone to make you angry. The Bible says, cease from anger, forsake wrath. That means we can do it. Anytime God gives us a command, His will is appealing to our will to do what He knows we can do. And He has empowered us. The Bible has a lot to say about anger. It's probably one of the most devastating emotions. It's related to other events and emotions in our lives. And King Saul's jealousy, you remember, jealous over David, led him to anger at David, not for any wrong that David had done, but actually for the good that David had done. And that led him to attempt to murder David. We said that in Matthew 5, 21 and 22, Jesus confirmed the danger of anger as the root cause of murder. So, I believe resting in the Lord is a crucial step in curtailing anger in one's life. Now, some of you, I think I mentioned to you last time, had kept up with the Slocum trial. And the guy was sentenced recently for murdering his mother, his stepfather, and his stepfather's son. And the testimony of many people was that he was a very angry person. And he got angry at his mother's telling him he was going to have to take his girlfriend and move out and make it on their own and quit sponging off them. So he said, I'll show you. So he killed her, killed her husband, killed her husband's son, and set the trailer on fire. Jesus linked anger to murder, so we can accept that unhappy alliance. And when I'm counseling people, I was counseling someone yesterday. I was asked to come to a rescue squad and help a girl who's in an abusive relationship. So I was counseling with her, and I said, the most important thing that you can do for yourself is don't allow yourself to become angry at the abusive conduct that's being perpetrated against you. The important thing for you to do is to keep control of yourself and make solid, sound decisions based on safety and principle instead of reacting. I said, if you react to anger, you can only react with anger. And so I said, you want to make sure you don't do that. There are many reasons we said that people get angry. I think we started with this one here. We said in verse 1, people get angry at people who keep doing the wrong And he says, fret not thyself because of evildoers. I see people doing wrong things all the time. They seem to get by with it, and nobody seems to say anything. They just keep doing wrong, keep doing wrong. And here I am over here trying to do right. They are benefiting from doing wrong, and I don't seem to be benefiting from doing right. So I'm looking at that thing. It's easy to get angry. Things like that. Fret not thyself because of the evildoer. And fretting is related to anger. It's a lead-in. In other words, fretting. Get this idea now. Fretting is worrying to the extent that you believe that wrong action is justified. Fretting is worrying to the extent that you believe wrong action is justified. Got to be careful. He says, neither be thou envious against the workers of iniquity. See, envy, it comes from a root word which means to burn. It carries with it the same idea as anger. King Saul's envy of David led to his pursuit of David in order to murder him. So don't let people who keep doing wrong cause you to allow anger into your own life. Another reason that people get angry, people who seem to prosper undeservedly. And that's related to the first one here. You see people prospering undeservedly. Verse 7, he says, rest in the Lord and wait patiently for him. Fret not thyself because of him who prospereth in his way, because of the man who bringeth wicked devices to pass. So we see these people, they are plotting against others. They are bringing evil devices to pass. They are constantly engaged in their sin. And sometimes they're even laughing about it. And they appear to be totally unjudged by God. David says, don't let people who prosper undeservedly cause you to be angry. And then thirdly, people who secretly plot against and use vicious tactics against us. People who secretly plot against and use vicious tactics against us. Verse 13. The Lord, am I in the right place here? The Lord shall laugh at him, for he seeth that his day is coming. There's some who plot against us, he says, and those people are going to eventually be cut down. Evildoers shall be cut off, he says in verse 9, a little while. The wicked, verse 12, the wicked plotteth against the just and gnasheth upon him with his teeth. And the Lord shall laugh at him, for he seeth that his day is coming. The wicked plotteth against him. The word plotteth is an interesting word. Good King James word, very, very frequently used in the 17th century, not so much used today. But it comes from a Hebrew word which means to plan something in a bad sense, to devise mischief against, to consider evil options, and to purpose evil towards someone, to plot someone's destruction. The Hebrew word zamam means all of that. And by the way, premeditation is strongly implied. As a matter of fact, in Genesis 11:6, this word is used of the people who schemed to build the Tower of Babel in order to rise up to where God was and pull him down. Sounds almost like the Soviets that said, well, we sent a spaceship up there and nobody saw God. Well, he probably didn't want you to see. You know, that kind of mentality. So this word also can be used in a good sense because it is used of God's planning to judge the wicked. It's also used in Proverbs 31 of the wife who planned what was best for her entire family. But generally when the word is used, and the King James translators translated it plotteth because of the context, it's used with an evil intent. So, people who secretly plot against us and use vicious tactics against us, if we're not careful, we'll get angry at them. And they will have actually taken control of our lives. So don't let those who scheme against you cause you to get angry. Because remember, anger is a choice. Another reason people get angry, number four, people who take advantage of those who are weaker cause us to get angry. I don't know about you, but I'm kind of an underdog kind of person. I find somebody who's an underdog, I root for them. I was with my partner yesterday, and he's a Syracuse fan. They were playing Kansas State and basketball and heading toward the championships. And he said, I'm a Syracuse fan. I said, who's favored? He said, Syracuse is favored by 10 points. I said, good, I'm rooting for Kansas State. Of course, we lost, but I root for the underdog. Well, I don't like it when people take advantage of those who are weaker than they are. I see that happening quite a bit. And many times I can do nothing about it. But if I do have the power to do something about it, I act. He says here, the poor and the needy, verse 14. The wicked have drawn out the sword and have bent their bow to cast down the poor and needy and to slay such as be of upright conversation. So, while we are justified in being angry about inequities, we are certainly not justified in allowing the anger to control us, causing as bad an action on our part as the injustice that we've observed. So the wicked go after the disadvantaged like a bow hunter pursues game to kill it. And particularly do they go after the righteous conversation, those of righteous conversation. It's interesting in our society right now, if you are a professing Christian, you're a target automatically. If you're Islamic, nobody can touch you. Isn't that interesting? So we can use anger to motivate us to do the right thing. God approves of that. But we cannot let anger control our conduct toward anyone because God disapproves that. Number five, another reason that people get angry. We get angry because there are people who promote and protect social disparity. People who promote and protect social disparity. Our president's been recently accused of promoting social division by trying to give certain people at certain levels in society benefits that other people don't get. The Bible calls that social disparity. Look at verse 16. A little that a righteous man hath is better than the riches of many wicked. Now, somebody was telling me the other day, said, I really like to watch this Fox News because they're always calling Donald Trump and getting his opinion on things. Well, I don't know whether this is good or bad, but I agree with Donald Trump on many things, but I don't think that we should call him just because he's built Trump Enterprises. There may be a local pastor in a small country church who has far greater perception than he does. See? But our society is bent on focusing on bigness. And this, of course, has crept into fundamentalism. Some pastor who has a church of 2,000 is considered right because he's running 2,000 in Sunday school. You're not right because of the size of your congregation. You're right because you are saying what the Bible actually says. So people who promote and protect social disparity, a little that the righteous has is better than the treasures. The little, how much material things some people have is used to cause others to be discouraged. And then the riches. The society focuses upon money, upon land, upon houses, upon status, and they define success with the word accumulation. Whereas the biblical definition of success, Joshua 1:8, is compliance with revealed truth. So, this focus on riches creates disparagement of others. So, don't allow others to cause you to be angry over the little that you may have relative to them. And by the way, somebody who's got a lot is going to really rub it in to people who don't have a lot. You're going to see that. So, the passage puts character over possessions. A righteous man with limited earthly resources, in God's eyes, is superior to a wealthier person who is wicked in the eyes of God. And that's what God says. So don't let people who boast of their material or social status force you to respond angrily to their charges. And then number six, another reason people get angry. People get angry when they see a lot of people who are takers, but they're not givers. Look at verse 21. The wicked borroweth and payeth not again, but the righteous showeth mercy and giveth. The wicked borroweth and payeth not again. The word for borrow generally means to take. You know what leeches are? Well, leeches attach. If you ever watched Humphrey Bogart and Audrey Hepburn in The African Queen, you've seen leeches. They attach themselves to you. They begin to suck the blood out of you. They contribute nothing to you, but they take everything they can take from you. Well, life has its leeches. They latch on to resources. They drink all they can while giving nothing in return. Then they move on to the next host and continue taking. Their whole lives are wrapped up in taking. Now, many pastors know about what we call church leeches. And I remember when I first came here, I saw this over and over. What happens, there's a network of people in society who we call the hobo community. And these people are not poor at all. What they do is they travel around from church to church, city to city, village to village. They give the impression that they are poor and needy, and they come and they ask for money, or they ask for you to pay for a night in a motel, or they ask for you to buy gas for them. They prefer, of course, to have money. Cold cash is preferable because it's untraceable. And so they're out there. You may not have had as much experience with them as I have, but I remember in Kentucky many, many times. One preacher called me one day, and he said, "Hey, Pastor, this is so-and-so pastor over here in named the little village there, Danville, Kentucky. Some pastor over here in Danville." He said, "Have you come across a man who has a kind of scraggly beard and an old floppy hat, and he has coveralls on and a plaid shirt?" And I said, "No, I haven't." He said, "Well, he's got his wife and kids with him," and he said, "they usually show up in a kind of a broken down vehicle." And he said, "they tell you some sob story about they have to travel 150 to 200 miles to see a sick uncle who's in the hospital, and they don't expect him to live, and they'd all like to see him. They'd like to be able to hug him before he dies." And he said, "they got all kinds of sob stories." He said, "I just thought I'd warn you." He said, "they took us to the cleaners over here." He said, "what they do is they go and they find a place where they can rent a wreck." You guys are familiar with rent a wreck, right? You rent an old car for the day. Maybe you pay, in those days, probably 10, 15 bucks for the whole day. And you park your nice car somewhere else, and then you run up onto the church property looking as poor and decrepit and as sad as you possibly can, and plead and beg for help. So he said, "I just want you to be alert." He said, "I followed them." And he said, "when I followed them, they turned in the rent-a-wreck, got into a Cadillac with a nice trailer on it, and took off down the road." He said, "we gave them $100. So he said, "I just want to warn you, they're out there." So I said, "okay, thanks, Pastor, for calling me." So I'm sitting there, and pretty soon I hear a knock on my office door, and I always left my office door open. People could walk right in the front, could come in and could see me. And fellow said, "Pastor," he said, "we're traveling," and he said, "I'm just wondering if your church could help us." I looked up at him, and he had the floppy hat on, scraggly beard, plaid shirt, overalls, worn out shoes. And I said, "so what's the problem? Have a seat, sir. Have a seat." So he sat down there, and he told me his situation. I said, "you know, I'm really sorry." I said, "I'm sorry about your relative in the hospital, and I'm sorry about the fact that he's, you know, facing death and you need help and all that." So let me ask you a question. You know, if you were to die right now, where you'd spend eternity? He said, "well, yeah." He says, "we're all Christians in our family." And I said, "where would you go if you died right now?" He said, "I'd go to heaven." I said, "you're sure about that?" "Oh, absolutely." He said, "back home where we're from in Hopkinsville, Kentucky," he said, we're part of a little Baptist church there. He said, "we're faithful to all the services there." I said, "well, that's really great. I appreciate that." I said, "let me meet your family." So I walked outside, and he introduced me to his wife and to the children, and had a couple of hound dogs in the truck, and had this old, about a 70 Chevrolet station wagon, and it was rusted and all of that. And so I said, "okay, let me go back into my office here," and I said, "I'll be right back out." I went to the office, and we had a local rent-a-wreck place. So I looked it up, the phone number, called rent-a-wreck, and I said, excuse me, "I'm Pastor Goodell out here at Frankfort Baptist Tabernacle. Got a man here asking for help. I'd like to know if you just rented a vehicle to this fellow." And I said, "he's about 6 feet tall, got a scraggly beard, floppy hat." And, "oh yeah," he said, "they were in here a while ago and rented one of our older car." And I said, "what were they driving?" He said, they asked if they could leave it here, and I let them leave it. He said, "it's a, see, this would have been 74. And he said, it's looks like it's about a 73 Cadillac, got a nice house trailer on it. And he said, yeah, they were here, had their family and everything. So they loaded up in that, and he said they changed clothes and all of that. And I said, okay, thank you. So I went back outside and I said, sir, I don't think I'm going to be able to help you. And he said, well, I thought churches loved Jesus and they loved God's people and wanted to help them when they're in need. I said, well, I just called Rent-A-Wreck down there. And he just turned and walked away. So I want you to know there are leeches around, okay? Now, there are also people who need legitimate help, and we want to help them, but these people approach the church, give a sad story and all of that, and when they think they're being caught on by a church, they leave and go somewhere else. So what we did is we wish we'd had cell phone to those days. I could have snapped a picture of him and could have sent it to all my pastor friends. But as it turned out, I just wrote a letter, gave the description. I said, if you got a Rent-A-Wreck in your town, be sure to call and ask if these people show up. I described who they were, the physical appearance and all that. But you say, well, those are terrible people. Well, let me ask you this. What about church members who never tithe? What about church members who never take a job in the church? What about church members who never minister to others, have never in their entire lives walked down the aisle with a soul that needs to be saved? And they come, they sit in the services, enjoy the activities, and they take, and they take, and they take, but they don't do anything. They don't bring anybody to a revival meeting. They don't offer to pick up some poor family and say, hey, let me buy you supper and take you to our church services tonight. Don't let actions of people like that prompt you to act in anger. You know, there's a lot of work to be done in the Lord's service. You're aware of that, right? Somebody said that 10% of the people do 90% of the work, and the 90% of the people who don't do anything are happy to let the 10% work themselves to death. And basically, every pastor I talk to says that's true in their church. One of the dangers, I think, in dealing with non-givers is to assume that the problem is that they're not giving. I mean, you'd think that, right? But we learned in the field of medicine that if I pick up somebody that's having difficulty breathing may not be the problem. If a person's having trouble breathing, he could have right ventricular heart trouble. I'm the one that needs to decide in the back of that ambulance whether that's the issue, because I can put a mask on him with oxygen, but if his right ventricle is backing blood up so that he's getting a pulsation in the veins in the neck, then that means that the left ventricle is not doing its job of pulling the blood out of the lungs, and so he's not getting oxygen. No matter how much oxygen I give him, it's never going to get to where it's supposed to get to. So don't assume that a person who doesn't give, don't assume that the problem is not giving. What does the passage say? Look at what the passage says. He says, where was that? Verse 21, yeah. The wicked borroweth and payeth not again, but the righteous showeth mercy and giveth. So, if the person is a taker and he's not a giver, the problem is that he's not right with God. I remember years ago we had a church member here that just really got angry every time I talked about tithing. And he pulled me aside one day and said, I wish you'd quit talking about tithing every service. I said, number one, I don't talk about tithing every service. I said, best of my knowledge, I've never preached an entire sermon on tithing. I believe that if you're right with God, you shouldn't have to have a preacher up here pounding on the pulpit saying, you need to be a tither, you need to be a tither, you need to be a tither. If you're right with God, I shouldn't have to tell you about that. Now, I told that fella, I said, you know, I believe that if you go somewhere and open your Bible and not have anybody interrupt you, no telephone, no television, no radio, just you and God get alone by a creek bank somewhere and you open your Bible and say, God, speak to my heart. I said, I don't think you'd ever get upset my preaching on tithing again. Because you see, it's the heart problem. You know, once I got saved and I realized what my responsibility was to the local church, I've been saved almost 58 years, and I've never missed tithing. Matter of fact, in the last 25 years, my wife and I have consistently given better than 20 to 25% of our earned income to the Lord. That's what causes the IRS to come after me so often. But you see, if the heart is right with God, giving will follow. One preacher used to say years ago, he said, whenever I get men baptized, I always try to get them to keep their wallet in their back pocket while they're being baptized. And I said, why is that? He said, because if the wallet gets baptized, I won't have any problem with their giving. Well, I don't know how true that is, but but if your heart's right, giving will follow. Not giving means the heart is not right with God. So you don't attack the giving. You know, Harold Boyd and I were talking about one day, and he said, you know, he said, this matter of faith promise, he said, if a person's right with God, he said, he's going to automatically respond to faith promise. And I never could figure out how in the world I was going to be able to give as much as I'm giving to faith promise. There's no way you can look at the bottom line and say that's going to work. But it amazes me how God always provides that money every week. And that was when Harold Boyd first started coming here. What was that, 20-something years ago, right? 25 years ago? Another reason people get angry is people who use ambush tactics cause us to get angry. Look at verse 32. And at verse 32. The wicked watcheth the righteous and seeketh to slay him. People who use ambush tactics, they make me angry if I'm not careful. And this is similar, remember, to verse 13? When we read verse 13, it said, the Lord, verse 12, I'm sorry, the wicked plotteth against the just and gnasheth upon him with his teeth. So it is similar to verse 12. But there is a difference. Let me give you the difference. Plotting involves well-organized strategy, and watching doesn't. Watching means that there's going to be an impulsive response because the person is looking for an apparent opportunity to present itself. So there's no plan. There's no plot. He's just sitting there watching and waiting. I'll tell you what this reminds me of. I was watching a special the other night on television about lions. It's interesting to watch how lions hunt. They're really smart. The men make the women do all the work. And then after the women kill the animal, then they have to sit back and wait while the men eat it. And if there's anything left, then the women get some. Now, that just doesn't seem right to me. Does it seem right to you? That must have happened after the curse, right? That must have happened after the curse. But you watch, that's kind of fascinating. But the thing that really amazes me is the lions, they don't sit down and figure graphs and all that stuff. They just sit quietly in a place and watch for an indication of weakness or isolation. They see a smaller animal that's strayed away from the herd. Man, they're on that thing. I watched them the other day pull down a buffalo that got separated from the herd, and the buffalo itself was five times the size of any one of the lions. But the teamwork, you know. One of them jumps up on his back and gets him distracted. He's trying to buck it off, and another one comes alongside and grabs the jugular. And he just hangs on to the jugular. And the lion is being dragged along. But they watch. To me, one of the most fascinating things in the world is to have a well-photographed lion hunt, particularly when the guy who's doing the photography can zoom in on the eyes of the lioness. Man, what penetrating eyes as she just watches. Just looking for an opportunity to spring. That's what he's talking about here. There's some people who do that. They sit back and they just wait for an opportunity to ambush. Plotting involves well-organized strategy. Watching means looking for an apparent weakness. And you know, the interesting thing, I was thinking back about all the church splits over, not just here, but in other churches I've been in. Both of those were used, the plotting and the watching. There were those who meticulously organized against the pastor and against the church, and then there were some that were watching, and out of fear, frustration, or ignorance, they just jumped on board. Which of the two do you think would be most likely to ask forgiveness and restoration of those two? The group that did the plotting or the group that did the watching? What do you think? watching, yeah. Yeah, because they weren't evil enough to plot the downfall of the pastor, plot the downfall of the church. But they were pulled aside by maybe friendship, association, or something like that. And then later they said, we should never have done that. And they would come and get it right. Well, we shouldn't let actions like that of deceptive people cause us to get angry. I mean, there's plenty of that going around, but we shouldn't let that make us angry, because that's control. Number eight, and I think this is probably the last one for this morning. Number eight, there are people who try to use intimidation to get their way. Don't let them make you angry. People who try to use intimidation. Look at chapter 37, verse 35. I have seen the wicked in great power and spreading himself like a green bay tree. Spreading himself. Big, big, big. Usually this involves someone in a position of authority. Sometimes it can be a pastor. It's going to be amazing at the judgment seat of Christ to see pastors who have been declared successful being called into account for abusive conduct toward church members. A lot of pastors have used intimidation on their deacons and on their congregation, and they've actually made them feel guilty and frustrated if they didn't come down the aisle with somebody every service. You know, intimidation. And then it can also be a deacon. I remember when I first arrived here, most of you remember the deacons we had here. Several of them were pretty well educated, and so it was pretty easy to intimidate the former pastor because he had almost no education. And they get Bible school training or something like that. So they used intimidation, because later when I talked to him, he told me about this. And but when I came here, they started trying to use intimidation on me. But they had a problem. The problem they had is they had a pastor who had more education than the entire deacon board. So they couldn't use the same power against me that they used against the former pastor. And so they tried to force me with intimidation and threats to ignore some obvious dishonest policies that were going on. So people with authority whose hearts are not right with God, they spread themselves in a giant display. Have you ever seen the puffer frog? You ever seen the puffer frog? I mean, it looks pretty small and unintimidating, but he can blow himself up, and when he inhales and takes in a lot, his skin is elastic and stretches, and he looks like three times the size that he normally is. And then it also affects the croak. The croak gets stronger like that, and he intimidates sometimes prey that he would not normally be able to go after. I remember years ago, you got to be careful of people who spread themselves, because all you see is the spread, and they'll use that against you. But my mom and dad were pretty well off before they got saved, even after they got saved. My mother was negotiating a $1 multi-million contract with the largest laundry in the state of Florida. She was going to purchase it. She owned 25 houses that she rented out. She owned her business, and she owned a beautiful house on Jacksonville Beach, very expensive, and owned a beautiful house on Santa Fe Lake. And my dad owned his own business, and my mother usually bought automobiles out of petty cash. That's how much money she had. And down on our property in Keystone Heights on Lake Santa Fe, when she bought that, she loved the fact, when she bought that house, she loved the fact that right in the middle of about 1 acre out there was a huge oak tree. People said it was probably hundreds of years old. Huge oak tree. Man, the roots on that, there's no way two people could stand on either side of it and put their hands out and touch each other and circumvent. It was too big. Trunk was too big on it. Huge roots. I mean, roots almost as big as fence posts running out, and you can see them going out there. And this thing just spread. I mean, spread. And everybody come by and say, man, what a mighty oak tree you got there in your yard. Oh, what a powerful looking oak tree. Boy, I wonder how long that oak tree's been there. Yeah, it provided shade for people. It looked impressive. Man, did it look impressive. I was impressed with it. And I used to climb up in the tree there, and I made me a little house up in there, you know. And people marveled at how glorious this tree, 60 to some odd feet above the ground there, the top of it was, powerful roots. But one day we had left Jacksonville, Florida. We'd driven down to Keystone Heights, and we pulled out into the rural area there, and pulled up into the driveway there, and we noticed that the tree had split down the middle, and half the tree was lying over here, had damaged some things over here, and half of it is lying over here, and some damaged some things over there. And my mother said, "What in the world? It must have been struck by lightning." Dad said, "We haven't had any thunderstorms down here. Been no thunderstorms." We walked over to it, and Dad pointed to the interior of it. He said, "Let this be a lesson to you, son." He said, "Even a mighty oak can fall when the problem is internal rot." And he showed me inside that tree how inside it had been rotting and rotting and rotting. Outside looked great. Looked really great. Really great. But you know, anger produces internal decay, rot, and eventual destruction. Every situation that I've been in which intimidation was used against me, I later found out about the rot and decay in that person's life. And that rot and decay had been well hidden. You see, the outward demonstration of respectability, authority, and influence had been great, but the rot eventually caused a split, and the tree collapsed. David warns us not to let intimidating people cause us to become angry. Why? He says, "If so, we will suffer the same rot and decay that they have experienced." As a matter of fact, one of the main concerns of a person who has internal rot and decay is to spread it to you. That's what they want to do. They want to spread it to you because they want to destroy you too. So if we're going to benefit from the waiting process, that's what we were originally talking about. We've got to learn to curtail our anger. What we'll do is we'll look at that as a kind of like a review next time we're together. Then Brother Don will be with us there. Let's stand for prayer. Father, thank you for your love for us. Thank you for guiding and directing us in our lives. Help us to realize that we do not have a prayer of being successful as long as we live our lives apart from the Word of God. No matter how much wealth we accumulate, no matter how much land we accumulate, no matter how many houses we buy, no matter how much prestige we achieve in society, we cannot possibly be successful in the eyes of the Lord while excluding the Lord from our lives. As we open the altar, touch our hearts, I pray in Jesus' name. Amen.